So I would like to welcome you once again to the podcast Postcritical Psychogeography from Weak Resistance to Weak Avant-Garde. That's not an easy task to say it quickly. And we have Patricia Reed, who is a professor at Eindhoven Design School.
Design Academy Eindhoven, yeah. And we don't have professors. We're like co-head of the
program. Academic, then.
Tutor, yes.
And also a fantastic artist with whom we spend a lot of time talking theory. Actually, also talking artistic praxis, but also theorizing. So I'm going to ask you first some questions concerning the avant-garde. Then we will go to the psychogeography / situationist inspirations, and then we'll explore a little bit more the planetarity, which is your big topic in the collaboration with Joanna Wersza. In Hamburg city curating, but also in your own research and work. So welcome, and I'm going to shoot the questions straight away.
Sure.
So what are your associations with the avant-garde? What do you think of when I ask avant-garde question mark? What comes to your head?
Yeah, obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is military. Obviously, there's this association. I think definitely I felt more, let's say, attraction to it when I was younger, you know, like a younger, you know, teenage artist or something like this. But it's something that I haven't really been thinking about all that much. And I should probably preface this whole thing by saying I'm a bit of a delinquent artist. I haven't made work in some years. I've been really just focusing on theory. So I'm maybe not the most, you know, just to kind of be transparent with the listeners that I'm not like actively practicing as an artist at this particular moment.
I'm somehow happy to hear it, because there is all kinds of reasons behind this professional choices, let's say. But I believe that one of them that strikes me as important in neoliberal era is basically that you don't try to be so incredibly productive as artist, and you're like, okay, for now I need to express myself as theorist.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that a lot, to be honest.
Well, I mean, yeah, and maybe that's one thing that maybe connects to this idea of the avant-garde, because, you know, obviously it's a very broad term. So many practices are included in that. But obviously the association that it would, an art, you know, artistic activity would have some impact at the level of everyday life. I think for me as an artist, it became, I really didn't understand the purpose of making an exhibition anymore. And again, this isn't even a critique against other artists or so on.
Yeah.
It was really like a personal existential crisis of just like all the resources going into that. And then in the end of the day, you have an opening, people congratulate you, and then you leave, you know. And I much more appreciated the immediacy of text, the type of community that engendered, that is, you know, as soon as something's online, it has the potential to be global connections, the discussions, the debates that happen out of that. So maybe that's one, let's say, tangent of the avant-garde that for me as an artist, it became like,
important.
Why do an exhibition, or why would that have to be the venue for art? So maybe that's one correlation that is like worthwhile to kind of link up.
But you also,
it's not necessarily like a macho, it doesn't contain that macho association that we typically get with the avant-garde. It was really just like, is this the best use of this type of thought in this very urgent moment? And I was like,
yeah, probably thinking and conceptualizing, and also finding patterns and understanding the notions that we are using. All this is currently in your focus, I would say. And it's important also, on one hand, as a refusal to produce all those objects and events, which are so omnipresent in neoliberal artistic economy and economy more broadly. But I think also this is a very situated practice. It's like, okay, where I am in Berlin and in other places that you go to and work, this seems like understanding the world and perhaps also finding new ideas and finding new solutions, mm-hmm. seems to be more urgent than producing those objects that people might enjoy otherwise. So I'm kind of fascinated by this turn. Also, I have been seeing you as theorist way before you made this shift. So somehow it's interesting for me also to be like, ah, okay, so now we have the practice that sort of follows, you know, an impression that that I had very early on, I think when we met in 2007-08 or whenever it was.
Yeah.
A decade plus ago, that was my impression that you were like working so much with these concepts from Rancière, from Badiou, and from other at that point mainly French theorists. And I found it fascinating that an artist is so invested in theory. So I believe that, you know, I would, because I'm conceptualizing the weak avant-garde now. So I'm looking at avant-garde and trying to think about what can we say from it, to put it very, very simplistically, like what are the important parts of that legacy that could be re-emerging or could be brought to life, but also that artists are actually bringing to life. And I think in your practice, as you just described it, is precisely that. It's like, yeah, let's be the vanguard of this society a little bit. Not by means of trying to win a competition with everybody else, but more of like taking the urgent matters and giving them some new conceptual frame.
Yeah, but I think in this moment, I mean, if you think about, certainly when I was coming of age, you know, in a Western, very stable, like Canadian art context, you know, disobedience was associated with art, like we were supposed to be the rebels and so on. And the issue now is, I mean, that's completely the fascist turn, right? Like, who is the transgressors now? It's all of that. And so that's something that I think many people are negotiating within art. It's just like, well, is that enfant terrible figure who we want to embody? Is that the moment? And certainly these things shift in time in different historical contexts, but certainly, you know, the cynical side of the avant-garde that definitely got became successful in this kind of uptake was the our labor practices, yeah. Right? Because artists, you know, our entire life was part of our practice. Let's say getting drunk at a bar is part of your work, you know, maybe. So there's no division of labor. And certainly the, you know, I can never say the word, the increased precarity associated with employment now means that even in your so-called free time, you're optimizing yourself for better performance in a labor market. And so there's, you know, I think that side of the avant-garde desire and legacy of art, you know, needs to be acknowledged, right? And in its, let's say, less favorable.
Absolutely. Or commodified version, basically, because this was appropriated so much by neoliberal work ethics.
It's a prototype of like labor at large, let's say.
But also I think what you just highlighted for me at least, but I believe maybe also for other listeners, is this correlation or coexistence of exceptionality and enthusiasm. And this is what capitalism is now really using to generate profit, is that we can take individuals and make them work extra hours. So this management of enthusiasm, as Kuba Schroeder calls it, and we all call it, on the one hand, and then the exceptionality. So this person is such an individual, let's like praise it. Yeah. And coming from critical theory, but also queer studies, and recently working on a project about anti-gay action by the police, I come to terms with the fact that perhaps we need to look at the less exceptional persons, events, and historical moments and practices as the ones that might be more useful, more groundbreaking, more resistant, let's say. So a part of this concept of weak avant-garde that I'm trying to shape, somehow starting with the weak resistance earlier. So the weakness consists not only in not being macho, but also it consists in being ordinary. So I look at the notion of common and commons from Negri, from feminism, from other contexts. You know more about that, so I'm waiting for you to tell me. But this concept of common, I looked at it also from the perspective of ordinary. So this is a meaning of common which has not been so prominent in the recent discussions of the common. But for me, it became so pertinent that we don't need anymore perhaps like another hero, but what we need is basically an ability to create in common as being together in a large group and sort of making new processes or opposing the current historical and economical processes, but also accepting the fact that perhaps the ordinary everyday strategies can bring some better results than those extravaganza activities, ultra avant-garde, you could say, activities that were so prized from the 60s on in art, but also in resistance movements, in the underground cultures, in critical theory, etc., etc. So I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess there were some strategies that were in this kind of extraordinary extravaganza or spectacle way. But certainly, like, when you evoke the psychogeographies, I mean, you know, to do a dérive on your own is hardly, this is about creating a different condition of experience for you. It's hardly a spectacle for somebody else until it's, like, analyzed as a kind of method of navigating, let's say, urban space or something like that. So in those ways, they feed into that, let's say,
Ordinary,
but they skew it nonetheless, right? Because the whole point of, I mean, we're doing the most obvious example, but the most, you know, it's not, if I go on a dérive today in Berlin, it's not really going to impact you, right? So it's not having that effect. However, is working on your own sort of perceptual level to have a different relationship with your surroundings, with, you know, stuff. So, you know, maybe it's also a question of where that spirit of transformation that is implied in avant-garde, where it takes place, right? Like, and certainly there's probably different scales that it takes place, and it probably needs to take place at those various scales, right? Because if it's just like celebrating this spectacular, you know, event thing, you know, then you always have the problem of like, well, what are the ramifications of an event if you want to do the Badiouzian angle? And so I think it would need to kind of connect with sort of everyday life practices, right? And
that's also the caring, the reproduction, or this invisible labor, no?
Yes, and this is why, like, when I think about Helen Hester's work on domestic realism, I think this is quite important because it's like a part of feminism sort of gave up the home. Like, no one's talking about the organization of the home as they were previously, that actually these are sites of in need of activism because precisely they structure everyday relations, right? Or everyday organization of everyday life and all that reproductive and care labor that you mentioned. And so, yeah, and those are not necessarily spectacular interventions, but so maybe it's a question, rather than thinking of it in this either or, and it's a question of like the scale of transformation is something, you know, when do you experience something that radically transforms what you thought was possible, right? For a lot of people that would be a nuclear family structure, or like, what does your apartment look like if it's not a family unit, right? Versus or compared to like a massive social upheaval or something like that.
I think that the concept of transversality comes in handy over here because it allows rejoicing or reinvigorating the situationist and other avant-garde practices in the ways that don't accentuate this exceptional subjectivity behind it, which was very much the board's focus, I think, and also Van Agem's to some extent. It was more like they were thinking in terms of like those exceptional figures who do those everyday practices. And I think you and me and other people, Helen Hester and other people working on resistance forms and critical formats today, we are more fascinated by the possibilities or also capabilities to connect as diverse and as different as subjectivities as we can be, we and others. So basically people who, for instance, never have been anyhow politically active, and how do we invite them in a political resistance? Because we can somehow, we have been there, we can do it. But also in Poland, we have seen the emergence of very grassroots feminist movement that was made partially in opposition to the existing feminist structures, because the, as they called themselves, ordinary women did not feel affiliated with this multi multimedia, highly educated, privileged municipal feminism. So they were starting their own movements, and sometimes they were connecting with existing feminist structures, but sometimes they were also incredibly critical, and rightly so, I would say, to some extent. So I think what you just told us about was basically a kind of reappropriation of the situation's legacy, but without the emphasis on this exceptional subject that is invested in it, but more into the practices, the strategies. And also, I felt a sort of openness to connecting with others, meaning not the like Western Europe's other necessarily, but others, meaning like people who are also here, and our neighbors, our whoever there is, basically, who in the difference, we can build alliances precisely because we have to live somewhere, we have to eat something, we have to breathe some air. And this is so basic practices that make alliances more feasible if we resign from this exceptionality of our own standpoint.
Well, yeah, and that's, I think, always a bit of the, you know, self-critical position of a lot of academics, right? A lot of really radical text and, writing about all of these, you know, grandiose political ideas, etc. And, you know, in a lot of cases, zero organizational labor backing that, right? And I'm certainly myself not an organizer or any of that, you know, nothing to do that, but I wouldn't be claiming to do that. And I guess the point I'm making is rather than like, you know, it's when you're taking on that kind of heroic position without doing that connective work and also recognizing the absolute necessity of that. You know, I remember even hearing, Christian Small, so the kind of famous Amazon labor organizer, right? And just like, you know, you're sitting there writing this paper, you're trying to be all complicated, or not trying to be, but it ends up, you know, like this. And then you hear an interview with him and he's like, you know, I needed to get people out. And so we order pizza and we have music and it's fun to be at these, you know, like just really basic stuff, you know, like, and it highlights the importance of these kind of affective attachments, the sense of belonging, the sense of like, being welcome into such spaces, that is like entirely, entirely important. And obviously it's usually not the task of academic philosophizing or theorizing to get to that level, but it certainly points to this kind of question of joy, this sense of awakening, the sense of possibility, because I think, you know, a lot of the resignation comes from the fact that we just don't think anything we do
exactly
change anything.
Yeah.
A lot. And for sure, it's a luxury position to even have the time as a kind of theorist to sit there and like stare out the window and write some words about our context if you're not like struggling, running 17 jobs and caring for children. All those sort of factors come in.
I think it's a good moment to stop this part of our recording and to jump into planetarity from here in the next one. So thank you for the moment. So one more time, let's welcome Patricia Reed, the artist and theorist and academic, and also somebody who is like organizing our thinking, I think, in many ways here in Berlin and in other places. So I think there is some content of the type of organizational work that you are actually doing, at least for me. But I want to ask you this question because I encountered some cultural studies, queer studies people who were very strongly arguing against practicing philosophy as it used the big quantifiers, as it uses the unfamous word we for political statements and all this. Mm-hmm. And you, somebody who thinks about scales and large scales, I think you do a lot of philosophical work, but I also don't think you come into those traps that those persons criticizing philosophy as practice were mentioning. So I'm kind of curious, like, where do you stand on practicing philosophy? Do you think it's still allowed in critical contexts and how resistant it can be and what is good about it? And then we'll go towards planetarity later.
No, absolutely. I mean, of course, I'm going to defend the practice of philosophy. That doesn't mean, you know, I think there's a really important idea from Lewis Gordon that is maybe important to bring in called disciplinary decadence, right? And I think where those critics against philosophy or any other field for that matter are attacking it is by thinking your discipline stands for, like, this philosophy is the field to understand our moment, or chemistry is the fundamental thing to understand our moment. And everyone gets caught up in preserving the discipline through the codes of language and jargon and all those things that we use to speak with one another, to kind of guard, to keep it as a silo. And what I think Gordon's, a critical diagnosis suggests is, like, that is actually a moment of withdrawing from the world, is when you're more committed to preserving the disciplinary silo than you are about pushing it, you know, and connecting it with reality, right? So let's just say my defense of philosophy is that it cannot be in a mode of withdrawal from the world, right? And it certainly does that very often, you know, certainly in our moment of, I'm thinking of the ongoing genocide in Gaza, for instance, you know, going to philosophy conferences and no one's adjusting their contribution to this state of the world, right? And you're just thinking, like, is this the moment to only be in this very insular thing, right? It's like we're, I think, as philosophers, obliged to contextualize our work in the present. And a lot of that is, conditions of our unchoosing, right? It's not my personal project to write about that. I'd much rather write about purely the planetary or purely technology or something. But, you know, this is the reality. And how can I use this position to address certain phenomena that are happening in our historical present? So in that way, I think I would defend philosophy, but, you know, with the caveat that it can't be withdrawing from reality.
I'm thinking also about the scale and about how to translate those minoritarian strategies. We were talking earlier on about psychogeography, for instance. This is a very par excellence minoritarian strategy for a small group of people. I can't really imagine a psychogeography of millions, although when you look at James Scott's analysis of the Far Asian protests in the 70s and 80s, you will see a lot of people doing precisely a walking in millions, and reshaping the understanding of their current economical and political condition. So you could call it psychogeography if you make a stretch. But I'm thinking about scale and your discussions of it as very important for imagining a bigger scale, because a part of this leftist melancholia that you mentioned under another name that I could now. But the leftist melancholia and the sense of impossibility comes from precisely the scale we are confronted with. I don't know, global warming, it's such a huge problem. How do we, in our small groups or as individuals, confront it? Obviously, there's no way of confronting it from that minoritarian perspective. So I'm wondering, what would you say from this philosophical, useful in this case, philosophical standpoint to that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think I'm thinking back to a podcast I just recently heard with Ray Brassier, and I think it gives a good angle, right? Like, philosophy is usually, it's often criticized for being abstract, right? But it's precisely that necessity of abstraction today that we need desperately, not only to gain some sort of better understanding of the stakes and entanglements of our present, but for building solidarity, right? Because we know that how impoverished a concept like solidarity would be if it could only apply to, like, I could only have solidarity with people like me, for instance, right? That's a terrible, terrible understanding of solidarity. So a degree of abstraction is required because you will not have the similar or same life experiences as those we need to be in solidarity with. So in that regard, I think that is a really important contribution potentially of philosophy, is to enable us to, you know, think accountably in those abstractions. And that often gets, a lot of people hate, want to push against abstraction. That said, if you're only thinking about that scale or that level that is a little bit detached from everyday practices, I think that's where you get into trouble, right? And there was a really nice notion. I'm not a Deleuzian, but when I was working on some of the, you know, some thoughts from him last summer, there was a really important concept that I thought, yeah, this needs to be said more often. It's just like, you know, if you get caught up in those abstractions alone, then, and you don't cross-reference them with reality, with a kind of empirical or experiential quality, they can almost, they can mask injustice, you know, and we're certainly seeing that very concretely with the abstract concept of international human rights today, right? That when we cross-reference with reality, we see how it actually is producing an injustice.
I see it very much, on the other hand, with this highly fetishized individual experience. So when people tell me that their experience in the archive is like making for it, I'm kind of like, okay, but if another historian wants to prove something and goes into an archive which is solely built of incredibly subjective and fetishized subjective experiences, they will not make a case. So I'm not trying to say that the justice system and its current rules are an ideal, but I'm trying to say that we are moving within a real society, and therefore we can have our idealized visions of how knowledge should be preserved or archived. But also sometimes we need to do something with this knowledge, and some practices of doing things with this knowledge require precisely its generalization, which is made impossible by
the hyper-particular.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think, but that also links, I think, I mean, because I know you wanted to seg a little bit into this idea of the planetary, and I think that just that movement that we described, you know, just now, this kind of empirical abstraction, particular, general, these things, I mean, you know, and even the fact that in a sort of modern lexicon, the global and the local are usually separate, and most scales are usually held as kind of polar opposites. Like, that's the important contribution of the planetary, is that it really radically undermines that separation of scales. So when we say the planetary, like, one of the first things that I would, you know, say to preface, because most people jump to a kind of solar system scale, right? And it's like, no. It's not that. It's a multi-scalar concept. It's a trans-scalar concept. It exists in a very, very local way. But through the series of entanglements, historical, material, chemical, biological, all of those things, all those forces, energetic forces, it exists at very different scales as well, right? And that's where I think we need that abstraction, because understanding those metabolic relations isn't, let's say, directly available to our realm of experience as it is now. So I think that's a really important point to emphasize about the planetary. And the way that I've been organizing it in my own thought is to look at this word, the planetary, as a kind of more abstract scientific or system science designation, and then building from Gyatri Spivak's idea of planetarity, which she uses in her work to really emphasize this degree of experience, inhabitability, etc. And that's where you get into, I think, even important differences in approaching some of the crises of our reality between, let's say, this model that is like championing sustainability compared to inhabitability, right? And I'm definitely on this latter camp of inhabitability. In which case, you don't get to speak about the planetary purely in this abstract way. And so certainly the lessons that we're, or the transformations of our understanding of how things work, the risks and et cetera that we face, it needs to take root, or it needs to manifest in a transformation of our practices, which brings me back to this ordinary, right? We're not going to just abstractly solve everything and imagine that everything in our life is going to remain the same. No, that's a kind of greenwashing approach.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about, because the names you mentioned, so Spivak and Deleuze, but you even they are very often presented as anti-dialectical thinkers or opposed to the concept of dialectics. And I'm trying to imagine how to build a system of thinking about all those interdependencies that we need to imagine if we think about individual versus more universal experience, or you know, climate and us, or whatever else we want to put. So I'm thinking that dialectics got a very bad reputation because it was simplified to this one-to-one binary sort of strictly opposed
thesis antithesis.
Yeah, exactly, which is a simplification even on the ground of the basic, you know, Plato, Hegel, other dialectical big names. Nobody, none of them would focus so much on those rigid, you know, conceptualizations, but they would do something that is really important. And for me to imagine, especially this big scale phenomena,
multi-scale,
exactly, even multi-scale. Sure. So then, yeah, but you can use modal logic to sort of multiply the relations on the dialectical in the dialectical picture. You can build so all these rhizomatics that Deleuze was and Guattari were theorizing. You can imagine them as being not just one-to-one sort of relations, but one-to-one relations multiplied. So therefore, you have like a gazillion of relations all in all. And that would be dialectic still, and yet it wouldn't be such a rigid thing. So to close it somehow, I would like to suggest, what do we do? Like, how do we work without dialectics? Or would you say that dialectics is possible to avoid? Or would you be like, okay, let's modify it? Like, how do you see that?
I mean, yeah, to be honest, I mean, I'm also not a trained philosopher. So I was never felt this need to be like, I'm a Deleuzian, I'm a Kantian, I'm kind of this and that. And a lot of people are. And so I tend to be a little bit more promiscuous with things than is maybe a normally responsible, like, just more promiscuous with ideas. Maybe I will answer it in an adjacent way to bring it back to this kind of questions of activism and avant-gardism that you're talking about is, and it does point to this polarity, because one of the founding definitions on the left and on the right, you know, and since like the early 20th century has been the Carl Schmitt, you know, it's us versus them. This is the definition of the political, right? And like I said, you know, Mouffe's famous for taking this up, but Gammon, they all kind of take this up, even under the guise of a progressivist thing. And to me, this strikes me that we need to fundamentally undermine that understanding of the political and rather focus on how do we construct we's, you know, and this goes back to your question and the one that we always get it, you know, who's the we of, you know, it's kind of a bit of an annoying question, even though it's kind of, it's annoying because it needs to be said, but it's like so often repeated.
Yeah, but does it need to be said in fact? Because it assumes, but I think
there's a bigger theory behind it that needs to back it up, right? And say like, actually, this is precisely where we need to orient an idea of the political. It's no longer based on the Schmittian principle or no longer weighted in that way, right? Because obviously constructing a we isn't just an all-inclusive kumbaya or like, people and ideas that should be excluded, obviously. But I think it's a really different weight, you know, that you give your, that you orient your political ambitions to. And also it helps to maybe move against some of the more identitarian particularism traps.
But also the individualism, because somehow the question, how do we create a we, assumes that initially, we are individuals, so it actually takes a very liberal, classical liberal, John Lockean standpoint.
Totally.
And I think that one way of dealing with the question of we is what you just said, but another way is to challenge the very concept that we are individuals as liberalism understands them, and conservatism and ultra-fascist conservatism as the Schmittian one understands them in the first place. So there is no individual in the first place, I think.
No.
And I would suggest that we are so enmeshed that our boundaries might be located in so many different places that all in all, we might very seriously assume that there is like a, you know, maybe species. Although I also don't think...
Well, the biosciences also teach us that, right? Like even, you know, you need a million microbes in your gut to digest, voilà, etc. But I think on that side, like, you know, some of the less helpful turns in a new materialism are just like, it's almost like they want to evacuate the social reality of these hierarchical divisions by saying, look, we're all just like atoms or filled with might.
Some atoms have better cars than others.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that, you know, it's not an excuse to do that, but it is one way that you can say how something like reaching a planetary understanding partially by way of the sciences helps us to reimagine ourselves, right? Like the liberal subject is impossible through a planetary lens. Okay, so like if we dissolve that, then we're, you know, how do we understand politics, right? And so I think these thought experiments are really fruitful.
So I'm gonna shoot you with a concept that you're definitely gonna be very surprised with. I mean, I can do it in mild way or in a hardcore way. So mild way would be Spinozian, right? There is like things have their conatus. So basically, if we take human brain, it is a tool designated also to take responsibility for our actions, not just to create, you know, fantastic things, but also to be responsible and to look at the planet and be like, perhaps there is something to be done here. But there's also another context from which I take my fascination, which is the Hegelian Marxism. And there you have a very useful notion of historical necessity. And that one, I think in the circles of antisocial queer studies and several other circles that I'm currently really struggling with, it's like the least beloved concept, but I think it really helps us to align our duties also and our, you know, our futures and everything. That it fits really nicely because we look at the planet, it's damaged, it's going to blow or otherwise be uninhabitable perhaps because of our human actions. So this is the moment, let's take responsibility and let's be in it together, right? So I'm curious to what extent, you know, any of these ideas, I know, very controversial ones, sort of apply in your planetarity thinking, or whether you have some alternatives, I don't know, but I'm curious.
Yes, I mean, yeah, again, I'm not like committed to those particular thinkers. I think how I would respond was like, I think actually one of the, let's say, things that is like, to me, very important in a political project is actually to re-understand that we have to constitute the idea of necessity, right? Like whoever says or whatever power structure designates necessity, you know what I mean? Beyond just biophysical sustenance or something, but whatever authority is imposing this artificial necessity, that is the political object, right? That needs to be contested. You know, part of it is to come to some sort of collective understanding and how we could create our own artificial necessity, paradoxically as a kind of dynamic of freedom. I mean, that's where you get into the more Marxian thing to see if I can be friends with you. What the heck? No. So it's not just a willy-nilly freedom. It's a freedom with accountability.
And also situated in a specific historical moment, in a specific culture, disposing of languages or discourses or narratives that are particular, no, to that. So there is all this designation that comes in and which is also very nicely explored and explained in the dialectical theory, and is much less explained, to be honest, in the more postmodern thinking that I'm suddenly becoming more and more critical of.
Okay, when we're talking about necessity, we can't, you know, especially when we're speaking about climate crisis, we can't avoid the topic of urgency. And that is very unequally distributed, right? And Marx is like deeply flawed on these points. You know,
yeah, that's luckily feminism came later and corrected it.
But human being is just like, you know, yes to kind of constituting this this idea or this concept of necessity. The question is like, which regions really have the most stakes in doing that, right? And there's certainly the band of like a lot of island nations around the equator are really sort of trying to have a very large voice despite this upscale of their nations, because of course the urgency of transforming into a different sense of necessity is like on them.
Absolutely.
At the forefront, you know.
But let's hope we'll contribute to making it more egalitarian. Thank you so very much for the conversation. We need to stop now due to the length of it.